Hello. Welcome to our CMD Bite Size series. In these podcasts, we will be exploring a range of ministry and theological issues. Good afternoon, and on today's podcast, I'm talking to Peter Watts. Peter is a therapeutic counsellor specialising in behavioural addictions, and he's run workshop and training for parishes and dioceses across the Church of England. So welcome, Peter, and thank you for giving me the time this afternoon to have a quick conversation with me about some of these issues. Can you begin by telling me a bit about your role and what you do?
So I'm a therapeutic counsellor, and thank you very much for giving me the time to be with you today. My job is to help people who are struggling with issues in life that they are trying to stop and have found difficult or impossible to stop, and they're wondering why. And that's pretty much working with addictive patterns of behaviour. I work on a one-to-one basis. I've also helped support groups in the past. And it's not only the individual who's struggling who comes to me to seek help, but also sometimes their partners or other family members who are being impacted by these behaviours, because it's never just the person struggling with the addiction who's being impacted.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. And I guess also it would be helpful to understand what addiction looks like in 2025. I'm assuming that we probably all have our own kind of ideas of what addiction is, and certain things that perhaps speak to us immediately, you think, well, like my immediate thought is kind of alcohol and gambling or drugs, but I'm guessing that addiction is in fact much wider than that. So can you give us a bit of a picture of what addiction looks like in 2025?
Yes, so classically the things that come to mind are alcohol and drugs. I think it's worth thinking about what is addiction, and a kind of a working definition of that may be a habit or a behaviour that is pathological, that it's being engaged with in spite of the harm it's causing the people that are doing it, that it's habitual, it's repeated again and again and has a ritual component to it. There's a compulsive sense about the behaviour that you have to do it, and also an obsessive sense that it takes over the thought life. So even when I'm not doing it, then I'm thinking about it, and that it gets worse over time. So I'm needing more or something new in order to get the same impact that the behaviour is giving me, and that it's altering my mood at the end of the day. So if we think about that as a kind of a framework for what is addiction, then you can say that not only are we talking about substance use and drink, alcohol, but that perhaps behaviours as well. So it's recognised now that there is a gambling disorder or a gambling addiction or a gaming disorder, and there are other behaviours that people engage in that we look at and say it's kind of out of control, it's causing a problem. And some of the cultural ones that are being spoken about are things like sex and pornography, gaming, internet use, phone use. Potentially there are other aspects around it as well.
Okay. So you've talked about actually how addiction is kind of changing some of those things that are coming into the fore with different technologies that weren't around in the past, and actually people become addicted to those. Do you think it's getting worse, or is it just different in the type of addiction?
Yeah, I suspect it's hard to say in a way. Having the opportunity can often mean that people will engage in things in a new way. But this desire to alter our moods and to support our lives by escaping from things or managing life in interesting ways has always potentially been there. Perhaps with the online environment, it's just easier to get hold of things. And so people do.
Yeah. And do you think you mentioned there about kind of escapism a bit? Do you think as lives perhaps become busier, and perhaps I'm thinking kind of they're less defined, working patterns are less defined, we're ever becoming a more sort of 24/7 culture, do you think that means that addiction becomes more of something that people need to escape from what they're not coping with? Is that one of the triggers, or is that not the case?
Well, more of what people need is an interesting thought. Potentially more of what people turn to because it's available. And yes, one can understand why increasing pressures around demands of work or family or other things that are going on, or increased anxiety about the state of the world, it's uncomfortable to sit with these things. And when it feels overwhelming, we will tend to turn to something to escape. And it's when that mechanism of escape becomes difficult and out of control that we can end up with problems. And at that point, it doesn't really matter what the behaviour is. It's the question of the relationship I have to that behaviour as to whether it's causing a problem for me and those around me.
Okay. So are there early warning signs that you think people can see either in themselves or perhaps in others that might kind of identify these things before they get so problematic?
It's hard to say with that, with early warning signs, and most of the people who come to me tend to come once it's got to be a problem, once someone else is noticed or once they are in trouble and the behaviour has really impacted their lives in a negative way. But I guess when you're looking at the pattern of development over time, there can be a question of, am I investing too much time in this? Am I investing too much money in this? Am I engaging in this that is having an impact on my relationships, on my family life, on my work life, on my income, on my health? And am I still wanting to engage in it in spite of all that? Then perhaps those are early warning signs. But most people don't really sit up and take notice until they have to sit up and take notice.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that kind of falls in with it being escapism as well, because actually, why would you sit up and take notice if that's your mechanism for escape from other pressures?
Well, let's face it, if this is a mechanism that is working for you, why would you want to stop it? And for many people, it's been adopted in life as a way that works. It started as something that I could do because I have the opportunity. It becomes something that I do and it becomes a habit. And then it becomes something that becomes a problem, but it still works as a release, as a way of dealing with life, as a way of supporting myself in life. And I'm not going to stop that until I have to, because what else is there to do? And if it is my way of handling uncomfortable situations in life or the trauma I've experienced in life, then why would I want to give up something that works, even if it has poor consequences on the side? And so giving up these things becomes quite difficult, and that's what makes it so difficult to change. And if you look at a recent example of an experiment that was done with phones and taking or encouraging school kids to give up their phones for a small period of time, how difficult that was to do and how quickly people wanted to pick them back up again at the end of the experiment that was done. And I think that came out in the press recently. So it's these behaviours are hard to give up. They support us. So why give them up until we absolutely have to?
Yeah, and I think that thing with the phone is so prevalent, I guess, for everybody, really, or for lots of people. Certainly, if you've got a spare 5 minutes, it's very easy to kind of scroll through your phone to pass the time, really. And what do you do if you're not doing that? And that's fine if you haven't got your phone with you. But actually, if you've got your phone next to you, it's very difficult not to pick it up and do that, isn't it? So very much so for children as well, or for younger people.
And that's one of the things where technology has changed the access to some behaviours. I mean, let's face it, 20 years ago, that wouldn't have been possible. And we'd have had to either find other things to do, or we'd have been left trying, acknowledging the discomfort that we feel and having to work with that rather than avoid it and escape it. And also, I mean, whilst scrolling through the phone can be a great way of killing a bit of time, there's also quite a lot of anxiety that you can find through the phone with regard to how algorithms work and how we're presented with media and social content that are not really designed to support us. They're designed to support the businesses. And so keeping us on the screen is what they want to do. But that's just phone side rather than addictions in general.
Yeah. Okay. Are there ways that you think that people could start to change their behaviours? Are there sort of techniques that you put in place that help people to deal with the addictions that they're facing? What would be the kind of recommendations?
So there are a number of things around working with addictions. One is, what is the behaviour that you want to change? But you need to also recognise, why are you engaging with that behaviour in the first place? Now, what is the behaviour you want to change? Well, that really depends on the behaviour that you're engaged with. If it's alcohol, for example, it's like, well, how do you not drink alcohol? If it's looking at pornography on the internet, well, how are we going to help you not engage with that? If it's eating habits, well, how are we going to change those? But if we don't deal with the why am I doing this in the first place? And that's very much like trying to put the cap on a volcano without looking at the pressure building up inside. And at some point, either the cap and the volcano will blow open and people will return to the same behaviours, or another fissure will arise. The magma needs to come out, and so it will be dealt with in another way. So just saying stop this doesn't necessarily help, unless you're dealing with the underlying reasons why that's happening in the first place, because all someone will end up doing is developing that instead. And we need to be careful not to end up playing a game of whack-a-mole, of addressing one behaviour and another behaviour and another behaviour, but each time without addressing the underlying issues The person needs a coping strategy and they'll find one. So there is this thing of behavioural management to start with. But equally, I think that alongside that, there needs to be a, why are you doing this? And how might you do life differently?
Okay, thank you. And I guess, yeah, getting to that underlying issue is so important, because as you say, otherwise you are going to just go around with finding a different coping mechanism. And that's even more damaging, probably, if you spiral out with different areas. So, yeah, I guess seeking help to identify what the problem is a real starting point.
Yeah, otherwise we end up with what is commonly called a control release cycle, where you control something for as long as possible, but the pressure gets too much, at which point you say, why continue this anymore? And you release and you go back to that same behavior again until you've decided, I don't want to engage with this anymore. I'm going to control it. And it just becomes a cycle that goes on and on and on, but nothing actually has changed.
Mm. Yeah, and that must be so challenging for people who are trapped in that position. I was just wondering, is there a story that's particularly impacted you that has inspired you to want to teach people more about addiction?
I think I hear stories from my clients all the time about the impact of their addictions on their lives. For some, it's financial impact. For some, it's loss of jobs. For some, it's loss of families. For some, it's loss of civil liberties because they've been caught breaking the law. And it's those kinds of stories. Plus, I've heard stories from the other side, from the families that have been caught up in this. So it's not just the person coming to me in pain, but the family members who have lost their fathers or their mothers, who have lost their connections inside and are falling apart, know something's wrong but can't quite figure out what to do about it. Those are the stories that impact me. And from a Christian perspective, it's that story of, here's someone who's made in the image and nature of God, who seems to have lost sight of that. And so trying to help them recover that. Here's someone who's not able to look at themselves in the mirror and say, I like what I see and I'm glad that I'm me. And helping someone recapture that. That is what drives me in this. It's seeing the brokenness that ensues, both in the individual's life and in the surroundings in which they live, and really wanting to see that change. And I love that. And I love that, seeing change happen. So I haven't got an individual story, a kind of a wake-up moment, but I do have that narrative from the work that I've been doing.
Thank you. And that's really powerful, because I guess in any sorts of roles like that, when you're hearing stories that are hard quite frequently, it can be easy to become desensitized to them. So it's really powerful that actually that still is a massive motivator for you, that you actually want to support people and help change lives, and that you can see that happening.
And there's times when also it's, for me, I have a passion about dealing with shame and working with shame in that sense. And there's a lot of shame around addiction, some more than others. It seems to be quite culturally acceptable to talk about alcohol and drugs. But when it comes to others, specifically sex and pornography, there's a huge amount of shame. And the number of times that I've sat with someone who says, I've never shared this with anyone else. And that's really special. And to help people recognize that doesn't mean that they're bad. It means they've developed a coping strategy that's taken them to places they really wouldn't have wanted to go to, never thought they'd end up in. But let's have a look at restructuring life so that they don't have to go there anymore. And let's have a look at how they can come to that place of looking at themselves in the mirror and saying, I like what I see. And that, for me, I want to see churches be able to do that more and more and more. After all, that feels to me to be central to the Christian message, to take away the fear and the shame and the hiding, and to enable people to live out of their fullness. And addiction is one thing that robs people of that. And I want to see that change.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other side of that, though, is the victims. When you're talking about sex and pornography, there are victims to those addictions that can be traumatized, are facing huge problems from the way they've been abused as well. I guess there's that, and how somebody that's doing those things, yes, they feel shame, and you want to deal with that, but actually, how do we honor the victim in that as well?
Well, and that's very, very, very true and very pertinent as to how do you honour the person who's been hurt by the behaviours. And sometimes that victim is the spouse. Sometimes that victim is the family members or other members within society. And helping that be addressed as well is very important. Now, a lot of people with addictive processes end up going to places like Alcoholics Anonymous, but an anonymous group for their particular behaviour. they're often referred to as 12-step groups. And one of the things that goes on in those 12-step groups is getting the individual who's attending them to recognize the harm that they've caused, and where appropriate, where it isn't going to be more damaging, to seek to address that. And equally, when working one-to-one with people, understanding the harm that their behavior is causing, not only to themselves, but to those around, and seeking to address that is part of the work.
Okay, thank you. You talked about that you've done some workshops with parishes about the work that you do. What sort of things do you hope to support churches with in engaging in this? Because obviously it's a very specialised area and you don't want people kind of leaping in, seeing somebody they think has got an addiction and trying to address that. What's the sort of guidance you'd give to parishes or dioceses when you're delivering those kind of workshops?
It's a massive topic. Spend a day on it. It could easily be taken much longer than that. I'd love to see something that's done as a residential weekend at some point, but taking a day over it is trying to help people understand the basics of what is it, how do you begin to recognize it. But there is this important side of do you have the competence and do you have the capacity to support an individual, or what can you give the individual that's come to you, and where can you refer that individual to for the help that they need? I think one of the things that surprises me often is the lack of awareness of how much is probably in any church that is being run. So for example, if you were to take a congregation of 100 adults, the chances are that 16 of those people, 16 of those adults would say that they're drinking to a hazardous level, with one of them acknowledging a dependence on alcohol. There could be probably three people in that group who are showing a drug dependence. There's around 4 to 5 people in that group who are showing addiction to sex and pornography. 13 people in that group may smoke. 8 of the women in that group may struggle with eating disorders. 4 in that group will struggle with gambling. 3 may have problems with the internet. Interestingly, 8 of that group may be over-exercising. And the statistics would suggest that 8 to 10 of the individuals in that group may have problems with their relationship with work. So part of it is the prevalence. How big is the problem in your group and how aware are you of it to start with? And then thinking through, what can we do, I think, as churches to see addiction recovery as a discipleship program rather than making it a special case? And I think that if churches were able to get their idea around addiction recovery as a discipleship program and implement it generally, it would benefit everybody and make churches more aware of addiction, but are more able to support people in their recovery. I think one of the things I'd like to say to that is I often hear people who come to me say, I wish my church was as supportive to me and as helpful and non-judgmental as my 12-step group, as my Alcoholics Anonymous or Sex Addicts Anonymous group is to me. I have never heard it said the other way around.
Okay.
I would love to see that change.
Yeah, and that's interesting, isn't it? Because it is about kind of building those relationships and not just having that surface, how are you today? I'm fine, thank you. Actually understanding where people are in those places. Really interesting, your kind of, I guess, like rainbow village of addictions and what sort of addictions people would be suffering from, because I'm guessing that a few of those we would not see as problematic in society. We'd actually see it almost as a positive sometimes.
Yeah, that's one of the fascinating things, isn't it, around how we deal with life. So the idea of a good work ethic, or he's achieved a lot through work, or she's achieved a lot through work, and that may be true, but equally, when that damages families, why is that individual spending so much time at work? What's the drive behind their need to be at work all the time? And are they potentially trying to avoid other parts of life and use work as a coping strategy? The same can be true for some people for exercise. I mean, I have worked with people who go to the gym a lot, and it isn't about wanting to be at the gym. It's actually driven by their own anxieties and their own self-image, which leads them to have an unhealthy relationship with exercise to the expense of other parts of life.
Yeah. Well, thank you for kind of clarifying that, because I think that's really important for us to see it from the whole perspective rather than just those things that we automatically assume are negative or hidden and that sort of thing. Because some of these things will probably be very open, like exercise and overwork are probably very visible as well. So it's good to be aware of those. If there was one thing that you'd like listeners to take away from what you've shared with us today, or a particular thing you'd like people to think about as they go away from listening to this, what would it be?
I think if there's an individual listening to this who's questioning a part of their life and saying, is this out of control? Then I would say, please don't be afraid to seek help and find someone to talk to about it and find someone to explore it with. I think for church leaders and the like, if they are looking at this and saying, okay, we need to find out more, then resource yourself, find out more, get in touch if you want to. It is possible to set up some kind of training to help people understand a bit more. Get yourself resourced, because the reality is that this will continue to be an area that we need to address as communities. And sometimes it can escalate quite quickly. So, for example, through the pandemic, we found that there was a huge escalation in the uptake of online behaviours, whether that was gaming, gambling, pornography use or other things, simply because of the environment people found themselves in. Now, when that disappeared, some of those people were able to walk away, but some others found themselves in problems. So I think my take homes would be, if you're struggling yourself, ask for help. If you're a partner who's been impacted, ask for help. Don't keep it to yourselves. And if you're a church that is interested, get resourced, get trained, and consider, what would it look like to look at addiction recovery as a form of discipleship?
Okay. Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you for sharing all of the information you have with us this afternoon and for being so open about the sorts of addiction that are so prevalent today in society. And thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to share, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
You've been listening to CMD Bite Size Podcasts, produced by the Diocese of Truro. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do follow and share. To listen to similar podcasts, please visit the Truro Diocese website. If there is a subject you would like us to include, please email us at ministry@truro.anglican.org.